Hello, GIST podcast listeners. Podcast, an audio medium. But really, I've been gearing up to make the big time. Yes, the GIST is now on Instagram. We started an Instagram page. It's a way to foment discoverability. I just always, whenever I was doing my interviews, I never realized that what I really wanted was to extract a one-minute clip with subtitles and big block letters. But it's really cool, and it's a really good way to help people find the show, because people don't pass around audio, but they pass around video, and we're populating the Instagram feed. Please go to PescaGIST if you're on Instagram, or join Instagram in order to go to PescaGIST. It's Monday, March 10th, 2025. From Peachfish Productions, it's The GIST. I'm Mike Pesca. President Trump has a plan to clear all Palestinians from Gaza, peaceful civilians and Hamas sympathizers alike. Recognizing this enormously difficult task, he's given himself something of a dry run, a test kitchen, if you will, with a more manageable population to practice on, Columbia University students. Here he can experiment with clearing out sympathizers through $400 million in rescinded federal grants, detention of a student protest leader on a green card. Why Columbia? The university essentially picked itself on the continuum of college responses to student protests. Columbia was perhaps the most lenient among the high-profile institutions. One could argue that some University of Texas satellite campus was similarly permissive, but that lacks Columbia's national prominence. When you say UTSA Roadrunner, it doesn't mean a thing. Columbia means Columbia. Even after Columbia's president resigned last year, student protesters this semester have been at it again, bursting into and disrupting classes taught by Jewish professors. Now, I would be incensed if I were a student in such a class, just as I would be if Jewish protesters shut down a Palestinian professor's lecture on Palestinian history. Yet, Columbia, unlike most peers, rarely punished or detained protesters. When they did, they largely avoided pressing charges or expelling students. That said, this is classic Trump administration overreach. I'm increasingly reluctant to excuse this with the fuck around and find out logic that appeals to the reptilian brain, but it's not particularly advanced. Columbia definitely needed some form of reckoning, but there is a vast difference between a reckoning and a wrecking ball. So the rescinded $400 million that could have funded medical and scientific research that would benefit students and teachers and Palestinian Americans and Jewish Americans and Americans who are Republicans and Americans who post too much on Blue Sky and Twitter. The Columbia student leader who was arrested, citizen or not, should have a right to political protest. That said, there's some evidence that he explicitly supported Hamas. More than some evidence, he seemed to have supported Hamas, not just criticized Israel's military response. Here, I'll read some of what his organization, the organization he negotiates on behalf of, has written, quote, "We could see in this axis of resistance where Hamas, Hezbollah, Ansarallah, and others have effectively used hierarchy and structured organization led by an anti-imperialist political line to carry out operations effectively." This is pro-Hamas sentiment, and there's more that I could quote. But it is true, to quote the Washington Post, that a student on a study visa can't have their visa revoked for beliefs or statements that are within the bounds of law. I think a good lawyer could probably prove, or maybe a better lawyer could disprove, that this is something akin to supporting a terrorist organization. That said, I don't see a better world emerging from the latest funding rescission and student detention. But it's also clear that some amount of correction was due. Columbia was engaged in some reforms with an anti-Semitism task force and a bit more punishment of student protesters. It was unclear whether the internal reforms would have been sufficient to correct the anti-Semitic excesses allowed at the university. But now that the university has been made an example of, things will certainly change. The pendulum swings, the sickle reaps. On the show today, I shall spiel about Governor Gavin Newsom and his new guest, Charlie Kirk. But first, Ellie Reeve is a reporter for CNN. Before that, she was with Vice. And while with Vice, she got herself very much embedded with the Charlottesville, Virginia neo-Nazi white supremacists. She has written a book on this entire phenomenon. It is out in paperback. It is called Black Pill, How I Witnessed the Darkest Corners of the Internet Come to Life, Poison Society, and Capture American Politics. Ellie Reeve, up next. Ellie Reeve is a reporter for CNN. She was a reporter for Vice, and she has covered in depth the Charlottesville attacks, riots, calamity. And then she has embedded herself and gotten to know many of the members of the QAnon slash neo-Nazi slash black-pilled community. It's an interesting subculture. It's also a dangerous subculture. And she cracks the code better than, I think, almost anyone else that I've ever encountered. The name of her book is Black Pill, How I Witnessed the Darkest Corners of the Internet Come to Life, Poison Society, and Capture American Politics. Ellie Reeve, welcome to The Gist.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Why, of all the things that a young enterprising reporter could cover, why were you drawn to this? Or was this just an assignment and you didn't ask for it?
No, it was all me. I often had bosses be like, can you just pitch something else, please? I got very obsessed with it. I guess the short version of the backstory is I was grew up in inner city Atlanta in a very diverse place. Then I moved in eighth grade to a very white place. And it made the racial politics of America very clear to me.
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, in 2015, I was online. I was researching another story. I ended up on 4chan, and I saw that there was a huge number of highly educated, savvy, young racists who were active, who were able to sort of swarm and work together to affect the real world. And I just couldn't let it go.
Well, they were racist, they were sexist, they were anti-Semite,
yeah.
And they were more than just sexist, misogynist, and self-hating men for the most part. But it was the racism that stood out to you, or was it just that in America
that's
most dangerous?
I guess, yeah, the racism stood out to me because where I'd lived in the South, there's racism in all levels of society, of course, but open, overt, like having the Confederate flag as your curtains kind of racism was stigmatized. It was downscale. It was trashy.
So, even in Atlanta.
Oh, Tennessee. Absolutely. That's the kind of thing you would drive by and snicker at is like a trailer house with a rebel flag.
Right.
Curtains.
Okay. Yeah. So when I say even in Atlanta, this was what, the early 90s, late 80s?
Late 90s.
Okay. So I was there early 90s. And there were Confederate flags. I'm not saying they abounded, but they weren't stigmatized yet by the time I got out of there in the mid 90s.
Or maybe I'm just thinking of my friends. Like in my high school,
yeah,
you know, it was pretty segregated, but people didn't, like, there were interracial couples, you know, like a basketball player and a cheerleader dated, and it wasn't scandalous.
Yeah.
Like, just that open, overt. I mean, I think when I talk about racism, people are not really imagining what it's like on 4chan, how extremely explicit it is. It's very, very ugly. It's like as dark as you can get. It's not something subtle. It's not just talking about they.
Yeah.
It's like very, very explicit. Like, the anti-Semitism is like Holocaust memes, like fawning portraits of Hitler and Goebbels.
So many drawings, so many caricatures with big noses, so many uses of the N-word. And so this was when you started getting into it. What year?
2015.
And what was the public's conception? If you say, I kind of forget, if you said 4chan to most people then, or to even someone who followed the news, would they know what it was back in 2015?
Maybe. It was kind of known as the dark heart of the internet, and it had generated a lot of memes, like Eichen has cheeseburger.
Sure.
Really, the format of the meme, it had been pro-Obama back in like 2008. So it had still a reputation as a place where you could see violence, crazy porn, but also funny jokes. But, you know, in the early 2010s, it had started taking a really dark turn.
Mm-hmm. And so when did Dylann Roof commit his
2015.
So that's when people started learning about 4chan.
I guess.
Yeah.
It started like your sort of tech culture writers started publishing more about it in the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a little bit of a catnip for journalists, since so much of journalism is trying to unearth what people really mean and hear people were just really saying it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so I was on 4chan the day that Microsoft released Tay. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
Yeah, well, I remember it from your book. It's sort of an early AI tool.
Yes, and it was supposed to act like a teenage girl on Twitter and interact with people and talk more like a human the more you interacted with them. And 4chan realized very quickly that they could turn her into a Nazi. And so just all working together, the only organizing principle being trying to one-up each other's jokes, They very quickly got her to say she liked Hitler. She rated the Holocaust a steaming 10. Like, Microsoft took down Tay within 18 hours.
Okay, so this was the ethic of 4chan was maximally offensive and transgressive.
Yeah.
How much of it, this is what you spent a lot of time trying to figure out, how much of it was bona fide actually believing in the precepts of Nazism, neo-Nazism, white supremacy, Versus just doing the thing that you know is going to be the most transgressive, which young men, unloved young men in their bedrooms are wont to do?
Yeah, there's not a clear and sharp line from one to the other, but a phrase that came up over and over again was it started as a joke and then became real.
Mm-hmm.
There's this one proposed law of the internet that what one generation of an internet community does, ironically, the next generation will come in, miss all those social cues that it's ironic, and start doing it sincerely. And many people I spoke to in Discord servers talked about that. Richard Spencer was the first person who said to me, it started as a joke and then became real, saying that young men had come up to him and said that they had researched anti-Semitism, racism, misogyny in order to become better trolls, in order to find better ways to piss people off. And in the process of doing that, had trolled themselves into believing it.
Mm-hmm. And you profile a major character in the book is this guy, Fred Frederick Brennan, who is, I don't want to get it wrong, is he a dwarf? He's 3 feet tall.
He has osteogenesis imperfecta, Which means his bones don't grow straight. So he's only 3 feet tall because his bones are curved and not strong enough to grow the way ours did.
So in the beginning, was he a true believer in white supremacy, neo-Nazism?
No, he was never actually a true believer
because
in
he
it.
Knew that white supremacy or a neo-Nazi would want to execute him as
well.
A
he agreed. Unfortunately, he agreed with that.
Yeah, he was.
He
not.
So he was born with osteogenesis imperfecta and could like never go outside. Like you touch his bones and they can break. I drove him around once and had to stop short at a stop sign and I hurt him. I don't think I broke his bones, but like, it was really scary how delicate he is. He ended up in foster care, very, very miserable, in a lot of pain. And he started asking, why am I like this? Like, why am I in this situation? He goes to 4chan. He goes on a board that's already getting a little bit pro-Nazi. And he asked them that question. Well, their answer is, your mom shouldn't have been able to have children.
And he agreed with that.
He found it compelling.
Yeah. And he became he started running a site, the Wizard Chan, was that it?
Wizard? He started running Wizard Chan.
Yeah. And so he got a lot of worth and value in that. He was an important person.
He kind of set himself up as a supervillain of the internet.
Right.
That his site would be the ultimate free speech paradise, where everything that was legal in America would be permitted. Mm-hmm. So only child porn would be removed and violations of DCMA.
And did he have an ideology at this point? I mean, I understand.
He's kind of libertarian.
I understand he's a miserable person. I mean, he was in misery so often. This is the first thing that gave him meaning. He actually got, I guess you could call her a girlfriend or a woman who had sex with him. And that was a major issue for him because it really hurts your incel cred if you actually have sex. But I'm wondering if we were to, it's impossible to find who were the people who said, okay, we're going to take the ironic and we're going to turn it real. Who were the actual people for whom that was a specific project, rational project?
Sure.
And you could blame a lot of it on Brennan, but I don't think he really believed it at the time.
No, he wanted to harness it to grow his site. He thought neo-Nazis could be bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
Stormfront, which was a longtime white nationalist message board. It was in the world of white nationalism, is called White Nationalism 1.0, like the old school. Those guys started
like
raiding.
Klansmen who actually wore hoods type.
League of the South, that kind of thing, skinheads. They started raiding 4chan. And there's was a derogatory name for them on 4chan. They called them Storm F slurs. Mm-hmm. But it worked. I mean, according to other moderators of 4chan, it worked. They really started convincing.
They found vulnerable people who were open to their message.
Yeah.
And they recognized that the irony was ripe to become real.
Right.
Yeah. But there were others doing this too. Now, what was Richard Spencer doing at this time? Was he involved in those efforts? He's a self-avowed, or was a self-avowed white nationalist. Now he kind of denies it.
Yeah, Spencer had been a white nationalist for a long time. He coined the term alt-right, but then he's like beefing with people and kind of abandoned it. Meanwhile, sort of 4chan people in that world captured it, took it on, and like made a culture around it. And when that started bubbling up, Spencer saw it and tried to sort of surf the wave of that. He started speaking in the lingo of memes, even though he wasn't a 4chan poster. He was not that sort of tech savvy himself.
Yeah. But he saw the opportunity too, like others did.
He saw the opportunity, and so did the media, in that Spencer would use his face and his name, whereas everyone else on 4chan was posting anonymously. And they would also raid Twitter. They would harass journalists on Twitter with anonymous Pepe meme avatars.
Yeah. Right?
So there was no one you could talk to directly where you knew who they really were, and you could tell, like, they were who they say they were, and they believed exactly what they said they believed. But Spencer sort of stepped forward and was willing to do that. Was articulate and also willing to answer questions.
So on 4chan, eventually 8chan, on the message boards, the ironic became real, and then the real became violent. That was seeming, in retrospect, somewhat inevitable consequence. But if you trace the path of that, how did that occur?
There started being these protests, like anti-Trump or anti-fascist protests, that the white nationalists would show up at. So one was Traditionalist Workers' Party. They were also sort of not exactly of 4chan. And they'd envisioned a working class political party that was fascist. I mean, they were openly fascist. Mm-hmm. And they sometimes got in fights with people like Matt Heimbach, one of the leaders, had used a Russian Orthodox cross to beat people with at a protest. So those fights started breaking out, and they became huge on 4chan. They would like go really viral. There's also a site called The Daily Stormer, which was like the Gawker of white nationalism.
Oh, I didn't know that about Daily Stormer.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of like the gossip tabloid.
Yeah.
And that front page is like really what would tell you like what's popping off in that world.
Right.
So when these brawls started happening, I think the first one was in Berkeley at a Milo Yiannopoulos speech. You know, there was fire. There's huge protests. Like that gets covered really big on the Daily Stormer. And then there's another Berkeley fight where this guy went out with like a stick and a shield, and he's like beating on anti-fascist protesters. That he becomes known as Based Stick Man, and is just absolutely celebrated. And like the videos of it go viral, right? And so people see that and they're like, I want to do that. I want to be that. So more and more people start showing up at these protests, getting in fights, and there seem to be no consequences. So they understood that this was happening, and they branded the summer of 2017 as the summer of hate.
Oh, who's the they? The message board, the most prominent posters, essentially?
Daily Stormer, 4chan, all these little groups that had started developing, American Vanguard, Identity Europa, Rise Above Movement, like all these little groups started founding with like different ideas.
Yeah.
And they had a big principle, which was no enemies to the right. They ended up chained to the most violent people within this movement.
Because their ethic was, we could never say, well, that's a little too far. So what did they do when there was a mass shooting, when Dylan Roof or one of these
Toronto, they celebrated him.
Yeah. And did they do it with a touch of irony, or was it?
Sure.
Yeah. And did anyone say, guys, this is putting back our movement?
No, that was called counter signaling, and you don't want to do that. That's very stigmatized.
Right.
So Dylan Roof had this very strange bowl cut because he was embarrassed of his forehead. And so they would put that bowl cut, they would Photoshop that on other images. A group eventually formed called Bowl Patrol, like in honor of his haircut.
Yeah. And because these guys have limitless time and many don't have jobs and they stick to their, I don't want to be cliche, but they do spend hours and hours on end in front of their computers. Every detail about the way someone looks or a rumor about how someone looks, or they can convince themselves that this is the right jaw to have, or this is the proper nose to have. I mean, this gets spread and it becomes doctrine, essentially.
Oh, right. Yes. The incels become very obsessed with the, geometry of your face.
Yeah.
Like the mid-face region is supposed to be this percentage of your face and the jawline, and they wanted small eyes and a big heavy jaw, and they would analyze these like Ralph Lauren perfume ads, you know, for like what a man should really be, and then spend hours and hours beating themselves up for not looking like that.
Right.
And then some would fly to Brazil for plastic surgery, or they would like post pictures of their face and be like, tell me, am I doomed for life because I'm so ugly? Like, how doomed am I?
And they kind of want to be told they're doomed for life. Yeah.
Natalie Wynn, this YouTuber, she goes by ContraPoints. She coined this idea of if it hurts, it must be true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really kind of like the principle that these guys had. Like, the more brutal this insult felt, the more real it must
be. And that's how you get cred, and that's how you get status, and that's one of the ways to go back to Fred Brennan. He got cred and status by talking about how miserable his life was.
Yeah, the incels had this idea that everyone is ranked from 0 to 10 in their attractiveness, and tens should be dating tens, but because of feminism or whatever, all the hot men are dating all of the women, leaving the men who are just 1s, 2s, and 3s with nothing.
Yeah. But sometimes the rankings change, right? The super chads can become a 10, but then there's a way for a beta cuck to actually...
to become a chad.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Through working out, through an all-meat diet. Like, there's idea that you could become a chad nationalist. It was, like, very aspirational.
Yeah. So this is totally bonkers, but it's a fun way for a lot of people to spend their time. And as we've chronicled, it is dangerous in the real world because already dangerous actors have preyed upon these vulnerable people and turned them into essentially either time bombs or just bomb bombs. Tell me about taking this idea, this community with a lot of festering dysfunction in it, and turning it into a spear. And was this essentially what Charlottesville was?
That's an interesting question. I mean, Gamergate was really the first time where it was like clear they could act together.
Yeah. Well, yes, but it was in online in real life. Gamergate was
online. Yes. So
yeah, someone alleged that his girlfriend was giving good reviews to video games because she was sleeping with video game programmers. Fine. And then this became this huge kerfuffle online. But people who weren't online didn't know or care about it.
Right.
But it, what would be the word, radicalized much of the online community. And the signal from that was what? What, when you said it showed that they could what beyond just get upset about something that was stupid and low stakes?
They could work together to create change. So they attacked Gawker's advertisers for their critical coverage of Gamergate. And that worked.
Yeah.
That worked really well.
Okay.
And they also led these harassment campaigns against these women who were critical of that and got like some of their public appearances shut down.
Yeah. Okay. So proof of concept that we have power. But what about taking that power? I use the phrase tip of the spear, or turning it into a spear. Real life.
Right.
Non-lone wolf who gets celebrated. But let's organize to specifically...
That's what
beat people up in real
to
life.
Be. Yes, to show that they could occupy physical space, that sure, they were online, but they're also real. There were really people who were committed, who would stand up and show their faces, right? They're not wearing hoods like the Klan. But Charlottesville ended up, it was like both the apex of the alt-right, but also its death, because it was so ugly, right? And people were so shocked by what they did. It had really disastrous consequences.
All right. And we'll be back with Elle tomorrow. We go into her experience with the Charlottesville lot and a lot more. That's tomorrow on The Gist. And now the spiel. Newsom splits with Democrats on transgender athletes, quote, it's deeply unfair. The remarks by Governor Gavin Newsom of California, potential White House hopeful, were an extraordinary break from fellow Democrats and signaled a newly defensive position on the issue. That's the headline and subhead in the New York Times. I read on to find the context and extent of the, quote, extraordinary break. There was more. It signaled a newly defensive position on transgender rights among many in his party. Okay. Then, the article said, the comment was part of a new Gavin Newsom podcast. Initial guest, Charlie Kirk, or as the Times described him, Mr. Kirk, who has a history of inflammatory and conspiratorial remarks. The article then relayed many short quotes from the podcast, taking time to describe or maybe contextualize and dismiss some of them. On his podcast, Mr. Newsom spoke at length about the political effectiveness of attacking transgender people in the presidential campaign. He called Mr. Trump's They Them commercial, quote, a great ad. He also questioned the practice of people announcing their preferred pronouns when introducing themselves. That makes it seem like he was dismissive, supportive of the They Them ad, and foursquare behind the effectiveness of, quote, attacking transgender people. Having listened to this podcast, none of those descriptions are totally accurate, because that's what I did. I listened to the podcast rather than read a New York Times description. I said to myself, wait a minute, the task at hand is listening to podcasts. Listening to podcasts is a large part of what I do. So I listened to the podcast instead of relying on the newspaper description, and I was surprised. I wasn't surprised that I was surprised, but the New York Times didn't fully encapsulate everything that went on. They made no mistakes of fact. Gavin Newsom did, in fact, talk about the political effectiveness of attacking transgender people, though he certainly didn't say it's effective to attack transgender people. He did criticize the Republican ads as a weaponization of the issue. And he did say, because if he didn't, he'd either be lying or ignorant, that the Trump ads were, in fact, effective. The full flavor of this Gavin Newsom podcast was interesting to me. I didn't actually expect the tone and content. Newsom was very solicitous. He agreed with Kirk over and over. You could argue he agreed with him too much. You could argue he should have argued more. But what he did was he forefronted his willingness to actively engage, and that allowed for an interesting conversation. Newsom's critics probably didn't want the governor to be interesting. I'm going to argue here that that's exactly what Newsom wanted, and that's a little bit of a break from Democratic orthodoxy. Deplatformers will not like the fact that he did all this through the vessel of Charlie Kirk, but that's how it's done. So let's go to the quotes. On the transgender issue, he did say,
But like, would you do something like that? Would you say no men in female sports?
Well, I think it's an issue of fairness. I completely agree with you on that. It is an issue of fairness. So it's deeply unfair.
Would you speak out against this young man, A.B. Hernandez, who right now...
Then there was some politician type back and forth about how he was just a dumb jock who could throw a baseball, but his wife was some sort of smart jock, Stanford, blah, blah, blah. And then he came back to this.
Completely fair on the issue of fairness. I completely agree. So that's easy to call out, the unfairness of that. There's also a humility and a grace that these poor people are more likely to commit suicide, have anxiety and depression. And the way that people talk down to vulnerable communities is an issue that I have a hard time with as well. So both things I can hold in my hand. How can we address this issue with the kind of decency that I think, you know, is inherent in you?
Now, what I hear there is Newsom absolutely admitting that natal males have an advantage against natal women in sports. 80% of the public agrees. I also heard him, as you did too, right, caveating that with other considerations and once more giving Charlie Kirk a little too much credit for being good faith on the issue. But this was not, to my ear, a policy change or a break with orthodoxy. It was an admission of simple truths. The LGBT Q Group Human Rights Watch has put out a statement casting doubt on the idea that men have an advantage over women in sports by pointing out such obvious irrelevancies as not all men are better than all women at sports, and by muddying the waters as to what the actual claims are. So here's the HRC press release. They called it a fact sheet. They did it in Q&A form. Q, what's the justification for these laws? Now, the real answer is that people don't want natal males to beat up on or just beat natal women in sports. That, of course, is the justification. The HRC tells us the justification is, quote, legislators have been repeatedly unable to justify the need for these laws. There's a broken link to exemplify that point, and admit that very few transgender youth even play sports. They, in fact, have justified it, just not in terms that the HRC approves. The justification is that the athletic benefit of testosterone during puberty on muscle mass, size, and strength has a demonstrated benefit in a raft of athletic competitions. The HRC rebuts its point, or at least uses some verbiage to get you to think that this isn't true. Here's another part of the press release. How do assumptions about the role of gender in sports impact people's first impression of sports bans? Are those assumptions correct? So what they do here is they take an accurate assumption, an assumption that is correct, which is that testosterone is beneficial, true assumption in the vast majority of sports, and they lard it up with some supposed other assumptions that are clearly not always correct. The HRC says it's an incorrect assumption that boys are inherently more inclined to succeed at athletics because they are taller, stronger, more mentally tough, or naturally more competitive than girls. Yeah, of course, that whole thing's an incorrect assumption, but just look at the one word, stronger. Not all boys are stronger than all girls. I feel stupid for having to say this. I'm sorry if you feel stupid for having to hear it. But of course, testosterone very clearly correlates to strength and often height. And also that strength very clearly helps in many, many, many sports. And that's what Gavin Newsom is responding to. Agreeing with the HRC's description of fairness is to agree with the HRC's inaccurate descriptions. And also, you know, Newsom nodded at the fact that there are other considerations beside the, quote, fairness issue. But I just think if it bears mentioning, as the Times did, that Charlie Kirk is inflammatory and inaccurate, so too should we mention that the people who are criticizing Newsom's position have been purposefully misleading readers of their fact sheet. The New York Times, which led me to the podcast, they were simplistic in their description of what went on there, but that was the headline, and I know that because I read 100 other headlines, and that's what they all pointed at. Newsom calls trans athletes in sports unfair in podcast with Charlie Kirk, and that is me quoting directly the Axios headline on the podcast. Now, headline aside, there was also quite a bit of criticism out there of Newsom for even engaging with Kirk. Now, I have some ambivalence on this issue. I think cross-ideological dialogue is very important, and the content of the dialogue was productive. I'm glad I heard it. It dragged on a little too long. In fact, I'd say it's almost too productive, meaning the Charlie Kirk I heard on that podcast was not the Charlie Kirk you hear on his podcast. On his podcast, he says things like this.
President Trump is the bodyguard of Western civilization. How President Trump and this election is not just the most important election of our lifetime, but the most important election of all the combined lifetimes since 1860.
Kirk wasn't nearly that stupid on Newsom's podcast. Now, I listen to a fair amount of Charlie Kirk. I don't like to. I check in. And also at the RNC, he broadcasts live from a prominent booth right outside the convention center. So I heard hours of Charlie Kirk broadcasting. It is not smart. I'm not saying he's not up to William F. Buckley standards. I am saying he is two levels below Ben Shapiro. I recognize Tucker Carlson, for instance, as being good at what he does, even if what he does is quite often bonkers. I never even thought that Charlie Kirk had such rudimentary skills. He was the sort of guy to go on the air after some idiot attacked the FBI, upset that classified documents were seized at Mar-a-Lago, and say this.
They're now going to try to play the victim after they occupied Donald Trump's home, a military occupation.
But he wasn't that guy with Newsom. The question is that a good thing or a bad thing? I, for one, was surprised that Charlie Kirk could engage on Newsom's level, such as it was. In fact, he trapped Newsom into some admissions that damaged him to some degree politically. So I will take the overall podcast, including the Charlie Kirkedness of it all, in the name of surprise and showing me something I didn't know. Also, apparently, it's interesting, Gavin Newsom's 13-year-old son is a fan of Charlie Kirk. I predict that Newsom is actually deep down pleased with how the podcast went, the attention that it got. He's certainly scrambling to smooth over hurt feelings among the LGBTQ caucus in his state. That's true. But the effect of a headline-generating podcast is to some extent the specifics of the headline, but to a greater extent the fact that it generated headlines in the first place. Newsom's podcast is now number 6 on iTunes and Spotify, ahead of NPR, ahead of Pod Save America, ahead of Tucker Carlson, and ahead of Charlie Kirk. That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara, CBSO, Michelle Pesca. Leo Baum is our intern. Umpru, Gpru, Dupru, and thanks for listening.